Next up, police should change their approach to allegations of sex abuse and not automatically believe the complainant. That's what the Metropolitan Police Commissioner, Sir Bernard Hogan Howe, has suggested. This follows criticism of the Met's handling of high-profile investigations into claims of historical sex abuse. Sir Bernard Hogan Howe has asked the former High Court judge, Sir Richard Henriques, to make recommendations about whether there are ways to improve procedures. The Operation Midland inquiry into a 1970s paedophile ring is among the investigations that will be examined. Sir Bernard said, "We are not afraid to learn how we can do things better." Back in September, I spoke to the radio presenter, Paul Gambaccini, about his experience with the Met.
The police had opened a dedicated phone line and a dedicated website and invited the public to accuse celebrities of sexual perversion, saying, "You will be believed." The police conduct was so below the standard of what is to be expected in a just society. They had launched an operation that was results-oriented rather than justice-oriented. The result was announced in advance. We are going to round up the pervs, celebrities from the 1970s. I criticize the top brass of the Metropolitan Police for what is and will be regarded by history as one of the greatest failures in the history of British policing.
So what do you expect the police to do when someone comes forward and says, "Paul Gambaccini has done this to me"? What do you expect them to do?
Well, it even goes back before that stage. You see, there was no evidence that the police understood the nature of celebrity. The man in the street is known to the people he has met in his life. The celebrity is known to the people he has met in his life and millions of others, for some of whom he has satisfied emotional needs. Almost everyone in public life has had a stalker or a fantasist. And the police don't seem to realize that when they ask people to condemn celebrities, they will include in that number a number of possible accusers who have never known the person. And this is why we have recently had this incredible string of boners by the police and the Crown Prosecution Service, because they've taken up the cause of people who never knew the people they're accusing.
Well, Jim Gamble is with us this morning. Good morning to you, Jim.
Good morning, Stephen.
Morning to you, and Luke Eatos from the online magazine Spiked. Morning, Luke.
Good morning.
Well, Jim, you heard Paul Gambaccini speak there, Sir Bernard Hogan Howe saying victims should not always be believed. What's your reaction to that, Jim?
I think Sir Bernard Hogan Howe is reacting responsibly and sensibly for the need for there to be an independent review of this.
My mistake there, Jim. It's not victims, but they obviously, because if they're a victim, they should be believed. It's complainants. My mistake.
Yes. Yeah, no, totally. And I think you've highlighted this in a number of your shows recently, and there's been a conversation ongoing. The key, I would say, is this. Post-Saville, there were huge lessons learned that many, many victims of abuse had remained silent because they hadn't been believed in the past and didn't think they'd be believed. So I think the key here is that victims aren't disbelieved. And of course, you could say, well, this is semantics now, but ultimately it's about how you inspire confidence in a person who has been the victim of abuse. And I notice Paul talks about celebrity, and I sympathise with what he says, but actually celebrities, like people in positions of power, have critical influence, and sometimes some individuals will abuse that. So we've got to make sure that when victims of abuse come forward, people who've survived for many years not being believed, that they don't think, well, I'm not going to actually be believed. So it's about getting the balance right. There shouldn't be disbelief, but there needs to be. So victims need to be treated credibly, and the police investigation needs to be carried out professionally. Where this has fallen down, I believe, is people announcing names to the press before the criminal justice system completes its investigation and its work in court. So if you're innocent until proven guilty, I don't think names should be bandied about prior to the completion of a professional investigation.
But the strategy of the police was to very publicly say, and you heard the statements, they were repetitive, so therefore they were organised in a particular way. And the message was to potential victims, the message to complainants was, "We will believe you. Please approach us. We will believe you." Is it the role of the police to believe a complainant any more than to believe someone who is accused of the crime?
I think when you're looking historically at the fact that complainants were not believed in the past, where there were huge cover-ups in the past, whether, you know, to do with people in positions of power or influence, the police themselves, of course, fit that criteria. So I think the problem here has been with the lessons learned post-Savile about how people in positions of public celebrity, people in positions of power and influence, have been able to hide their offending in plain sight because people have been afraid to come forward.
Luke?
So I think...
I'm afraid your speaker is part of the problem. This is not a problem simply with Operation Midland, nor with Mr. Hogan Howe. This is a problem regarding a society-wide panic around particular kinds of cases, which has led to an abandonment of the presumption of innocence in relation to those cases. And we should go back to the Savile report, the report prepared between the Metropolitan Police and the NSPCC, which was called Giving Victims a Voice. Now, this report was significant because it elided victims and complainants. It said that the evidence given to the report would be treated as proven fact. So these were allegations which were not going to be tested, but treated as proven fact and set down on public record as proven. It was at that stage that we knew that the Metropolitan Police were prepared to completely abandon their obligation to actually investigate cases and instead were completely willing to accept the word of people making allegations against high-profile figures. So really, it's bigger than the Met. It's bigger than Hogan Howe. This is about a society-wide problem. And this, let's be clear, has led to a collapse in the rate of convictions for these kind of cases. We've seen across the last 2 years, the number of people being charged in rape cases and sexual abuse cases has gone up, but the rate of cases ending in conviction has gone down. That means that more innocent people are being prosecuted, and very possibly more defendants who are in fact guilty are walking free. And this is all because both the police and the Crown Prosecution Service have abandoned their obligation to investigate and treat allegations with a healthy degree of scepticism, and have instead opted to blindly believe what they are told, fail to investigate the case properly, and then end up with cases which don't meet the proper evidential standards for a conviction in a jury court.
Is it not dangerous to give a sceptical message to someone who is making a complaint?
No, it's not dangerous. In fact, it's dangerous to give a believing the idea that you are going to blindly believe what you're being told. It's the police's job to be sceptical, because it's only through scepticism that the evidence that something has occurred can arise. If you believe someone, you're not going to investigate.
Well, Jim Gamble, it's all very well us talking about this here in the coziness of we haven't been a victim of sexual abuse. But Jim, you've dealt with some of those people, and them being believed is part of the criteria that is needed for them to come forward in the first place, is it not?
Well, it's not about them being believed per se, because I actually agree with what some of the last caller said, even if I don't agree with the way he actually said it. This is about creating an environment where those people who've been abused because of a breach of trust with people in positions of authority feel that they can come forward and that they won't immediately be disbelieved. So if you don't understand the historical context, which the previous caller obviously doesn't, of the legacy of pain that survivors of this type of abuse in such large numbers that we now know exist have lived with, then you need to be careful about what you say, because actually you prevent them coming forward. The criminal justice system is designed to be an adversarial system. So he who alleges must prove. And that means that when the police carry out an investigation, they do it to discover whether and or by whom a criminal offence has been committed. We've got to get back to the basics. So the system works when a person is investigated and the police decide there'll be no further action because there's insufficient evidence, or when a person is taken before court because the CPS feel there was enough on balance, but the court in that adversarial situation give the person the benefit of the doubt and they get off. What we've got to stop doing is talking about people's names in public. Do I think we should apologise, or the police should apologise to Lord Bramall? Absolutely not. Not for investigating an allegation. But perhaps there's grounds, and let's see when the inquiry takes place, to look at and apologise for the way in which a particular investigation was carried out. So balance is key. We don't want people to think they will be disbelieved. We want to encourage them to come forward, and there needs to be appropriate mechanisms, checks and balances, to protect those individuals who are accused whilst the professional investigation takes place.
Do you think a name should be released at point of arrest, at a point of charge, Jim?
Currently, names should only be released at point of charge. My own view on this is that when you're dealing with historic cases, sometimes the police get involved in using tactics to see whether other victims come forward to add corroboration, additional evidence to the case. That's a very high-risk strategy, and sometimes it has to take place. But I think unless there are exceptional cases, I personally wouldn't name people in these instances until conviction. That's my own view. I don't think we should name an individual in this type of case until conviction, because the stigma that is attached to you once this type of allegation is publicly made against you is something that's very hard to shake off.
Do you agree, Luke?
Well, I agree with some aspect of it, but I think the diagnosis is wrong. The reason why it's so problematic to have your name in the press in relation to these allegations is because the presumption of innocence, the idea that someone is not guilty of anything until they have been convicted, is held in such low regard. That's actually a far more complex social problem than I think your caller's giving credit for. What we need to do, I completely accept that complainants shouldn't feel as though they're going to be disbelieved, and I think there's certainly some truth in the idea that in decades past, the authorities treated these allegations with less scrutiny than they deserved. But the point is now that I think there's been a wide social acceptance that the pendulum has swung way too far in the other way, and that what has happened as a result is that one of our founding principles of our justice system, the idea that someone, when they're accused of something, is not guilty of anything until the fact has been proven, and proven in a formal way, the fact that that has been completely emptied of all its value. So I don't think that keeping people's names secret necessarily helps, because really what we need to think about is the presumptions that we bring to these kind of cases, and say, look, you can name the people if you want, but we have to recognise that until a guilty verdict has been passed, this person is innocent of any wrongdoing. And there's all sorts of social reasons why that has been emptied of its meaning. So I think we need to focus more on the presumption of innocence rather than on tinkering with the way that we announce names to the public or tinkering with the way that we treat publicity around particular cases. I think what we need is a principled stand in favour of the presumption of innocence, and I think that would solve a lot of the problems.
Yeah, presumption of innocence might be okay on paper, but you know how society works. You know that a large part of society, Luke, works on no smoke without fire, whether someone is proven innocent or not.
Well, I agree, but that's the problem. The problem is that we now live in a society where allegations are given more credence in the public, not just at an official level when it comes to prosecutions, but also in our public discussions of these cases.
Were you comfortable, for example, Jim Gamble, the very high-profile case where a helicopter was flown over the home of Cliff Richard by the BBC? He's plastered all over the BBC's news network. Now, on one hand of that, it is factually true that the police were entering his home as part of an investigation. So that's factually true.
Might be factually true, but actually investigations aren't about publicity and shouldn't be. So standing outside someone's home, whether they're dead or alive, to announce an investigation is crass. Flying over the crime scene to simply elicit more publicity around the investigation is crass and unprofessional. I thought that at the time. I still think that.
And yet, you know that in cases, for example, Stuart Hall is a classic case, isn't it? The former BBC presenter, that the publicity around his case meant that other real victims came forward, and that's how he was properly prosecuted.
And therein lies the complexity of looking back in history at offenders, because those people that offend against the weak and vulnerable in society, in this sense, using their power of celebrity and control, they never have just one victim. The issue I want to come back to, though, is the stigma. When you talk about, you know, the presumption of innocence, I've been involved in counterterrorism, in traditional policing, and in child abuse investigation. And I have to say, nowhere does the stigma stick the way it does around anything to do with abuse of children. Because once you hear of an investigation, parents are at once horrified that it could have happened. They're then terrified that it might happen to one of their children. And they don't tend to forget the person's name that's associated with it in the early stages of the media that surrounds it. So it's very different than other types of criminal offence. And actually, you know, what the other caller is saying, I agree with so much of it, and I think we actually agree with a lot of what's being said. Where we differentiate is public mindsets aren't going to be shifted because we say and reinforce, you know, one particular message around, you know, the presumption of innocence. People are innocent until proven guilty. When it comes to an investigation that's ongoing, it's about how we respect that and how we're seen to respect that through how we engage with the press, how we share information, and how we take that person, if appropriate, to court.
So when you were in the police dealing with sexual crime, Jim, did you get many requests from journalists for names to be released?
Yes, we did. And the policy was that on charge, we would have released the name, which is the current standard. When you have sufficient evidence to charge a person, where they're going to then face proceedings for that.
So you're saying that's the current policy, but of course what we know happens is the name's released on arrest.
And that's why I'm saying the issue here, I think, is about the manner in which the investigation takes place, not the fact that an investigation occurs. If someone comes in and makes an allegation, there should be an investigation to establish whether or by whom a crime's been committed. How that investigation takes place then defines how professional and the police service dealing with it are.
The way it works, by the way, is that the police don't officially release the name on arrest, do they? What happens is, if a journalist gets a sniff of a name when someone has been arrested, what happens is the journalist will contact the police and the police will essentially release a statement where it describes a 42-year-old man has been arrested. And that in itself confirms to the journalist that their story is right. That's the way it works, right?
I can help on that, actually. I mean, I think it's worse than that. I've had clients, high-profile clients, accused of very serious offences, and their names have been leaked to the press. In fact, we found out, I have one example, where we found out one of our clients' court dates from the press before we were even informed of it. So there is a direct line between some officers of perhaps the police or perhaps the Crown Prosecution Service and the press and the media in these cases. And that is because, in a large part, it is thought that by releasing in the most public way possible people's names and the initial details of what is alleged, it's thought that they could bolster what might be, in the first instance, be a very weak evidential case.
And what if that is true? So what if the person is guilty, but it's weak at the start and the police need more evidence?
Well,
what if that's true, Luke?
Well, I mean, firstly, it's problematic if the police delegate out their responsibility to source evidence to the press, because obviously, for obvious reasons, the kind of corroborative evidence that arises as a result of these trawling operations is going to be far weaker than if they'd done a robust and rapid and efficient investigation in the first instance. But secondly, it also gives rise to the very real possibility that complainants come forward who exhibit the kind of characteristics that Paul Gambaccini was talking about, you know, the kind of celebrity fantasy.
There's a couple of problems with that. Can I just say that there are a couple of problems with that? Sorry, first of all, I thought Luke was a journalist. I didn't realise he was a lawyer with clients in this field.
Well, do you want to clarify that, Luke?
Well, I'm a bit of both, but my profession is as a defence lawyer, yeah.
Right. Well, I think that's an important clarification, given the conversation that we're having. But let me just come back to a few things you've said. The issue is that when people come forward following an appeal, and as I've said, looking historically, there's a lot of complexity around these investigations. So when you look back, there won't be the immediate access to DNA, the immediate access to real or physical evidence. So sometimes when you do a broader appeal, you will test whether or not the people that come forward knew one another, whether or not there's a modus operandi, the way the person did it. So they couldn't have known each other, but they describe exactly the same MO. The person did it in exactly the same way. So there is in essence, a legitimacy about that approach. And given that you're dealing with something that happened a very long time ago, sometimes that's the best way to do it. And let me say, from my own personal experience, people who did it a long time ago, in my experience, and I've been involved in thousands of these investigations, are generally, if they're still physically capable, doing it today. It's the nature of the sexual predator. So we need to have balance, but let's not swing it too far the other way.
Well, that's interesting.
Push people backwards.
Yeah, Jim, that's interesting in itself. So maybe you can elaborate on that. So Is it, and I genuinely don't know this, is it very seldom the case then that a sexual crime is only committed once by that individual? Does
if you have a sexual predator who focuses their attention on children and young people, and they're in a position where they're able to gain intimate access to them, then those are not one-off offences. Look at Dr. Miles Bradbury, you know, cancer physician who's currently in prison serving a lengthy sentence. He was caught for downloading images. But when they actually began to explore his pattern of behaviour, which obviously there was an indicative interest in children, he was abusing the little boys he was examining, and he abused over 18 of them. If you go and look at these cases, you look at the cases that have gone through the courts recently, Jimmy Savile, Stuart Hall, Max Clifford, there is a pattern of behaviour that's not a one-off. We're not talking about an opportunistic sexual encounter in this. We're not talking about a one-off act.
Well, surely that surely the logic then follows, Jim, if we listen to what you've just said, that if the police receive evidence where they think there is a credible possibility that someone has been sexually abused, then they know that if they create publicity around that, they will get genuine additional complainants.
But there's other ways of doing it. So on occasions, that can be legitimate if you've exhausted your other lines of inquiry. So what you should be doing is actually, if a person was at an institution, if a person was in a school in a particular network, you should be identifying that network, that school, that care home, and you should be interviewing sensitively other people who were there at that time. You should explore all of the other avenues because, you know, what Luke says, and I do agree with, sometimes you can weaken your own case by spreading it too wide, too quickly, if you haven't been seen to exhaust all the other avenues to collect best evidence and that's not tainted by any pre-public knowledge. So there are ways and means. I think the pendulum has it swung too far. My fear is that now with so many people coming out pushing us back, that we will lose the ground that we made in getting victims to come forward. And Luke said he doesn't want them to come forward in a climate of disbelief. And this is where we get into the difficulties about language. So we don't want them to come forward thinking they won't be believed. So then what are we saying? And I'm saying we want them to come forward and believe they'll be taken credibly, that they'll be supported, and that there will be a thorough and professional investigation.
Do you say the same thing to the alleged perpetrator at the
Absolutely.
Beginning of the investigation? Do you sit down with an alleged perpetrator when they're cautioned, and do you say, look, we will do our best here to listen openly to what you have to say?
Is to discover whether and by whom an offence has been committed. It is their duty, if they find evidence that indicates the person is not guilty, to disclose that. It's about being professional. It's about being professional. And that's what I think will come out of this review. It's not that there shouldn't be investigations. It's the way that they are carried out.
Go on, Luke.
Critically important.
Can I just say that I think that the problems that existed within the investigation of these cases in the past, I don't think were just because these allegations were, within the police are particularly difficult or there was particular misogyny within the police. I think society's attitudes have changed so much that today I don't think police officers need to be told not to treat complainants with disbelief. I think that if a police officer today, in today's police force, is confronted with an individual making a complaint of sexual abuse or sexual assault, they're not going to be dismissed. They're not going to be told to sling their hook because they might have been done in the 60s or 70s, because not just the police attitudes have moved on, but all of our attitudes have moved on with respect to these cases. So I think there is a degree in which we can say, trust officers to make the right decision. Don't try and instill any kind of climate, either of belief, disbelief, or anything. Emphasise to officers that they need to investigate, to do their job, to obtain evidence, and to do so with rational judgment. That's enough.
Look, thank you very much indeed. Jim Gamble, thank you. Morning to you both.